bit later.
One minute.
It's kind of dark in here. Do you want the lights on? The desk lights.
Oh, okay.
Resolving a lighting issue here first. Okay. The second case for oral argument this morning is Master Blaster, Inc., Appellant versus Supreme Pork Appellee. For the appellant, we have Mr. James Redman, an attorney from Sioux City, Iowa. And for the appellee, we have Mr. Ronald Parsons, Jr., an attorney from Sioux Falls. Mr. Redman, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court. My name is James Redman, and I represent Master Blaster in this lawsuit. I would like to say at the outset that the brief that we have filed in this case, initially on page 1, contained a typographical error. The second sentence on the statement of facts should say that the plaintiff has claimed that the fire originated in the attic of a mechanical room in which two gas power washers were located. And there was testimony that that is not necessarily the case, and it continues to be in dispute. This arrangement between Master Blaster and Supreme Pork goes back some time, but in 1999, Supreme Pork had a fire, and they asked a Master Blaster to sell them a new unit and repair a unit that was in the fire. It was a fire that occurred in their power washer room, and Master Blaster gave them the price for a new unit and also told them approximately what it would cost to repair the old unit. The work was done, and the unit was delivered. The power washer room had to be rebuilt, and Mr. Hoffman was the individual who rebuilt that room for Supreme Pork. When he did so, he testified unequivocally that he put 12 inches of fiberglass insulation into the attic of the room. Later on, that became very significant. He was insistent that he used fiberglass. He didn't use anything else. He had never used cellulose insulation, which is what the plaintiff's experts later on found existed in the upper unit. Insofar as the venting was concerned, Master Blaster indicated to Supreme Pork, Raleigh Nevins is a representative for Supreme Pork, who was speaking to Mr. Miersma, the owner of Master Blaster, and he had a lengthy involvement and history of working in the hog business, was familiar with these types of power washer units. He testified that he wanted to be sure that the venting was correct. Mr. Miersma for Master Blaster said he doesn't do any venting. He has no understanding about what has to be done, but he did recommend Pipestone Plumbing and Heating for that purpose. So Pipestone went out and did the venting to the two units. Each of the units that were sold, I should say the one unit that was sold new and the repaired unit stand next to each other, and the venting runs through the ceiling. There's no dispute about the fact that the venting of those two units by Pipestone was done by the installation of a Class B vent, which is a double-walled vent. So the gas goes through the center, and then there's an outer vent that goes through the roof and the ceiling of the room where the power washers are located. The unit, one of the units, froze up in February of 2002, and Master Blaster was called to repair the unit. The unit was taken out and repaired and brought back to the hog facility was not installed by Mr. Meersma. He just dropped it off. Supreme Pork employees installed the unit themselves. They also installed at that time an LB White heater, which was run from the ceiling. And the testimony was that that wire that ran from that LB White heater was run around the wall and down to the other side of the room next to the door, and it was stapled to the wall. The employees who were deposed from Supreme Pork denied putting any insulation in at that time. They did admit that they put the heater into the same room. So about 3 weeks later, after the unit had been installed, this fire occurred. Mr. Rollis was contacted to do a cause and origin investigation, and he went to do an investigation at the site. The fire chief, who had come and put the fire out, put in his report that the source of the ignition was electrical and that it was wiring on a fiberboard. When Rollis got there, he looked at the facility and immediately came to the conclusion that it was caused by the venting. Mr. Rollis was deposed twice in order to identify his opinions. The first time he testified that he believed that the it was a single wall vent that had run through the ceiling. He could not identify which of those vents had supposedly caused the fire, but he did believe that it was one of them. Where the single wall vent attaches to the double wall vent, he felt that that attachment was improper and the gases could escape into the attic, because he felt that the origination of the fire was in the attic. Later on, about a year or so later, Mr. Schroeder, who had done an investigation initially for L.B. White at the scene, was actually hired by the expert to testify, and he actually reconfigured the unit as to how it existed in the room, and you see some CAD drawings in there, and it showed him clearly that actually the attachment from the single wall vent to the double wall vent was below the ceiling, about 8 inches. The individual who had supposedly used this machine for about 3 hours the day before the fire testified that when he came back, shut the unit off, it was before 3 o'clock, there was no brown burning, no discoloration in the ceiling, nothing above the power washers, which would indicate that the somehow or another this connection of the two pieces of the vent had allowed gas to escape and cause a fire. And they also had to deal with the issue of the fact that the vents had been installed and the units had been installed in 1999 and had operated without any difficulty for over 2 years. So once Mr. Schroeder was brought on board as an expert, we know, took his deposition. Initially, he said, well, the problem was there were no shields. And we knew that there were shields. Later on, he filed a second report which said, well, yeah, there were shields, but somehow or another they moved. And that's when Mr. Schroeder changed his opinion and said, the problem here is that there were shields, and they're supposed to shield the vent in the attic at least 1 inch, so you keep the insulation away. And in this case, when it was installed in 1999, if the contractor put in 12 inches of fiberglass insulation, the vents would have run through the ceiling, the shields would have been around the vent in the attic, and it would have been surrounded by 12 inches of fiberglass insulation. Both Mr. Schroeder and Mr. Rollis then changed their opinions to, well, yes, there were shields, and yes, there were 4 inches of clearance, but they weren't properly attached to the floor, and somehow or another something moved to allow this insulation, which now is cellulose insulation, to come in contact with the vent and cause the fire.
Now, all of that you had prior to trial, the fact that they had changed their opinion?
Yes. We took Mr. Rollis' deposition twice, and we took Mr. Schroeder's deposition twice, primarily because their opinions had changed. Never, ever did either one of them say there was ever a problem utilizing this double-walled Class B vent. Single vent coming out of the heater attaches then to a double-walled vent, which goes through the ceiling and through the roof. They also said nothing about the fact that the shields that go around the vent have to have top covers. And, of course, during trial, it became apparent that the contractor had put fiberglass insulation in there, even though they denied ever putting any cellulose insulation when they had this freeze-up in 02, there was cellulose insulation found, and according to Mr. Schroeder, approximately 5 inches of it. So now we got into the issue of, well, how did it get there? This is when the theory developed that, well, you should have covers over the shields so that nothing can go over the top of the shields and get next to the vent.
Are you saying that this cellulose, this 5 inches of cellulose, the dispute over that didn't develop till actually in the trial?
What we were saying is Hoffman testified that he put fiberglass in, 12 inches of it, and Mr. Schroeder is testifying that he is finding up to approximately 5 inches of cellulose.
I'm asking, when did this discrepancy develop? Was it at trial or was it pretrial?
We developed it during the trial itself. And Mr. Kern, who was a fire investigator, found that there was a dispute between the two insofar as what was actually supposed to be there. But we had taken, for example, we had taken Mr. Hoffman's deposition, and it was read at the time of trial, well in advance, where he said, 12 inches of fiberglass, I never use anything else. And we had taken Mr. Schroeder's deposition, and he said clearly it was cellulose. And the difference is cellulose burns quicker. So we got into the discussion with Mr. Schroeder. Excuse me.
So basically what you're talking about is the ignition point between cellulose and fiberglass. Fiberglass, it takes a little more heat to get that going than cellulose, which is basically newspaper.
That's correct. Cellulose is nothing more than ground-up paper.
Now, and let me ask you, the information that you have raised that why you should get a new trial because of this undisclosed expert testimony. Normally, when something like that comes up in trial that is ambushed or that you weren't aware of, there's usually a hearing outside the jury, and the determination by the judge would be what sanctions can I impose, because it's a discovery issue, I'm assuming, that they didn't turn over discovery like they were ordered to do. Did that take place any place in the record where you requested that information, maybe as a sanction, not be produced to the jury?
It never developed until the time of trial. In other words,
even at trial, was there any, when it started to come up, was there any effort on your part to request the court to enter some sanctions and possibly prevent that evidence from coming in?
Yes, we did.
Okay.
In other words, what happened is Mr. Schroeder came in well into the trial, and he brought with him a Type A vent, which showed the covers covering the shields. So basically what you had is you had a big old vent, and you had like a tub effect around it, which came up and then circled the vent itself. We had an extensive discussion in front of the judge about, Judge, he never even came up with this until about 2 days, and he talks about the fact that a couple of days earlier, the expert had called some manufacturers and tried to come up with this exemplar, and he came up with it. And we said there's been no evidence, no reports, no depositions by any of the plaintiff's expert at any time saying there was anything wrong with using a Type B vent. And The shields that were used, never was there the issue of they should be covered. This is something that they developed during the course of the trial.
And so what did the trial court, what reasoning did the trial court give when it made the ruling?
The trial court allowed them to talk about type A vent, but gave a limited instruction to the jury and prohibited them from utilizing this exemplar. And we had filed a motion in limine and had a court order which said that no expert will testify to any opinion that they have unless it's been given prior to trial.
So are you saying then the court, what's the standard of review? Abuse of discretion in this case?
Yes.
All right. What if the judge did limit it, entered some limiting instructions to the jury or to the counsel, I'm not sure exactly which, but why wasn't that sufficient? Why is that then abuse of discretion? What should the judge have done?
The judge should have said that you cannot talk about any opinion that you did not express either in a report or in your deposition. You can't talk about the fact that there's the need for these covers. You can't talk about the fact that this type A vent would have served any purpose. You have to stick with what you have said in your depositions prior to this and your reports.
I didn't see where you objected to Rollis' statement that it doesn't have a top mechanism on it. And it also appears this was raised in cross-examination itself.
We didn't have any choice at that point, Your Honor, because we had raised it out of the presence of the jury when they had the exemplar that they were trying to use to talk about a type A vent and covers.
And the court kept the exemplar out.
Yes.
And you didn't object to the testimony that I just mentioned.
It was our understanding that they were not going to be able to talk about the type A vent without a limiting instruction, which is what the court gave.
Oh, I'm talking about the shield now.
The covers.
The covers to keep the cellulose from getting in from the top.
Right. Yeah, we don't believe that that should have been allowed to come into evidence.
But I didn't see you objected to it.
Well, we made a statement at length out of the presence of the jury about the covers and the type A vents.
That was an unlimited request, or what?
Yeah, that was out of the presence of the jury when they were bringing these exemplars in and going to talk about how the covers would work and how the type A vent would work. One of the central issues that we fought about was the agency issue, which was taken away from the jury. Actually, Judge Cirska initially said, I've got a proposed instruction here to use on the agency issue, and for some reason he changed his mind. He said, no, I'm going to direct that Pipestone is the agent of Master Blaster and that Master Blaster is responsible for everything that their agent, Pipestone, did. The problem that we had with that, of course, is that there was significant testimony in the record by Mr. Miersma that he knew nothing about venting, never professed to know anything about venting, had no tools, didn't supervise this work, wasn't present when it was done, wasn't asked to inspect it, never inspected it. Mr. Nevins, the representative of Supreme Court, never disputed that. There was no dispute about the fact. The only thing that Nevins could say is that he was concerned about a fire in the facility and that Mr. Miersma had used this Pipestone Plumbing and Heating to do venting in the past, that he used these double-walled vents and made the recommendation, and Miersma followed that.
Mr. Redman, though, you got to answer the question. Under Minnesota law, it didn't appear to me to make a difference.
Pardon?
Under Minnesota law, what difference did it make? Under Minnesota law, an independent subcontractor subjects the general contractor to liability.
Only if that is the bargain for agreement. In other words, if the bargain in this case is, as the plaintiff claims, that they're getting a system and they're subcontracting part of the system out, that's one thing. But Mr. Miersma never guaranteed a system. The only thing he was selling was a brand new washer and a refurbished washer that had been damaged in the fire.
He bid it as one project.
No, what he put down on his statement was outside labor chimney work. It was very clear during their discussions that, and Mr. Miersma testified, he knows nothing about venting. It takes a master plumber to do the venting, and he's used this pipestone in the past, but that doesn't mean that that's the bargain for consideration that you're going to warrant. In fact, he had a written warranty for the two power washers. Very specific one-year warranty. That's the warranty that he gives. He was not warranting the venting work. He didn't know anything about the venting work, testified unequivocally that that was the situation.
Your time has expired.
My time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Redman. Mr. Parsons, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. Mr. Redman, there really was not a lot of mystery at all to this particular case. Supreme Fork hired Master Blaster to install a new pressure washer system. That included fixing a burned pressure washer, installing a new one, and adjusting the or reconfiguring the venting and servicing these machines. And that was bid in a complete bid submitted by Master Blaster to Supreme Pork. They included as an element of that a price for the venting work. And then Master Blaster on its own subcontracted with Pipestone Plumbing and Heating, as it testified that it did routinely on all of these types of projects, to do the venting work. Master Blaster's president and Pipestone's president were old friends. Pipestone did the work. It billed Master Blaster $850 for the work. Master Blaster paid Pipestone. Master Blaster then submitted its final bill for the entire project to Supreme Pork, charging $929 for the same work that Pipestone had charged $850 for. So Supreme Pork or Master Blaster actually made a profit on this. That work eventually turned out to have been negligent. Now, when this fire occurred, there was a fire investigation conducted jointly. All the relevant parties were invited to attend. Supreme Pork hired Chris Wallace, a certified fire investigator, and he was there participating. Manufacturer of the heater that was in the room hired Dr. Robert Schroeder from Minneapolis, and he participated. And the manufacturer of the pressure washers hired Mr. Cox, and he was also present. They conducted the investigation jointly, according to NFPA principles, and all agreed that the fire had occurred, had originated, in the attic space directly above the pressure washers. They all ruled out electrical factors as being any potential cause at all. There was no electrical wiring that part of the building or that part of the space where they agreed it originated, and all the wiring in the room was in metal tubing. And the heater was on the other side of the room, and there were not even any flames near that when the fire ignited. There was a witness who looked in the room, and that part of the room was not even on fire where the heater was located. So all of these experts unanimously agreed, who were present for the joint investigation, that the fire had been caused by the cellulose insulation, which they confirmed was there, connecting with these extremely hot gases that come out through these the vents, the chimneys that went through the roof. And somehow, the cellulose insulation had been allowed to make contact with that, and it smolders and ignites, and it's an accepted process known as pyrolysis. So, after that occurred, an action was brought, and Chris Wallace was the witness for Supreme Pork. Supreme Court then also hired Dr. Schroeder. Master Blaster hired initially a man named Jeffrey Washinger as their fire expert. But immediately, or 3 months prior to trial, he testified that he saw no reason to dispute Dr. Wallace's or Dr. Schroeder's opinions. And he cannot dispute them. And so Master Blaster announced that they weren't going to call him anymore. So actually, Supreme Court Pork read his deposition testimony into the record at trial. The experts called at trial by Master Blaster were two. One was Mr. Cox, who initially had written an opinion saying he saw no reason to disagree with the conclusions of Mr. Wallace and Schroeder that it had been caused by cellulose insulation encroaching the venting. He said that immediately after the investigation in 2002. He was hired by Master Blaster 5 years later, and then by the time he reached trial, his testimony was simply, actually, I don't know what caused the fire. The other expert hired by Master Blaster testified at trial. He was hired after Mr. Washinger was jettisoned, 2 months prior to trial. He spent 3 hours reviewing the photographs, and his opinion at trial was also, I don't know what caused this fire. So based on the expert testimony, the jury found on two separate theories that Master Blaster was liable for the negligent construction of these vents by their subcontractor on negligence and breach of warranty. And there's been no appeal from the sufficiency of the evidence on either claim, and there's been no appeal from the damages issue. There's been several issues appealed from, but the two we've talked about here today are alleged undisclosed expert testimony and this subcontractor issue. Now,
subcontractor issue,
yes,
would be a reversible error, would it not?
If it were true that there were disputed facts on whether or not, if it were true that the question is whether Master Blaster had as its employee Pipestone Plumbing and Heating or as its independent contractor Pipestone Plumbing and Heating, and if there were disputed questions of fact on that issue, then it conceivably would be reversible error. Actually, that body of law has absolutely nothing to do with this case. The actual issue they've appealed is the failure to give a proposed jury instruction, or a set of them. And it's in the back of their blue brief, the instructions they propose, and what they actually said was, one of the issues raised in this case is whether the work performed by Pipestone Plumbing and Heating was as an independent contractor or as an employee of the defendant, Master Blaster. And then it set forth the various factors for distinguishing independent contractors from employees. That has nothing to do with this case whatsoever. No one suggested that Pipestone Plumbing and Heating was an employee of Master Blaster. And the cases that they've cited, and they cited to Judge Surska over and over, were cases involving car accidents and workers' comp, in which the question was the milk truck driver who got into the car accident, was he an independent contractor for the milk company or was he an employee? That's not the question in this case. The question in this case is whether or not Pipestone Plumbing and Heating was Master Blaster's subcontractor. And it is undisputed, absolutely undisputed, that they were. Master Blaster filed a third-party complaint pleading that Pipestone Plumbing Heating was its subcontractor. They filed briefs stating that they were their subcontractor. Master Blaster's president, Paul Miersma, filed two sworn affidavits stating that Pipestone Plumbing and Heating was his subcontractor. Mr. Redmond represented Judge Keene at a pretrial hearing that they were their subcontractor. Judge Keene found that they were their subcontractor in an earlier opinion on the personal jurisdiction issue. At trial, we had this attempt to try to suggest, well, wait a minute. Pipestone Plumbing and Heating was only really a recommendation that we made, kind of like you would recommend a dentist to a friend. But the undisputed facts were Pipestone Plumbing and Heating had absolutely no contact with Supreme Pork. They never talked. They never knew each other. And the Pipestone Plumbing and Heating testified his client, and he always did on these jobs, he did almost all this work for Master Blaster, his client was Master Blaster. And on cross-examination, Mr. Miersma admitted, yes, I hired Pipestone Plumbing and Heating. And if I read the reply brief correctly, that Supreme Court has, or that Master Blaster's filed, they seem to admit in their reply brief that Pipestone Plumbing and Heating was their subcontractor. Now, if that's true, and I think we all agree that it is, or at least I think Mr. Redmond agrees that with that now, if I read his reply brief right, then Minnesota law leaves no room for any discretion. As a matter of law, then Master Blaster is responsible for the negligence of its subcontractor in performing the contract work. So there is no jury question here. And Judge Sirska absolutely gave the correct governing, controlling Minnesota law. It would have been reversible error and ultimately confusing to give the type of instructions they were suggesting. Now, the alleged disclosure or alleged introduction of undisclosed expert testimony. All the things were kind of mixed up in Mr. Redmond's presentation, I respectfully suggest. Their issue, he was talking about vents as they related to Dr. Schroeder's testimony. Well, there's not even an appellate issue related to Dr. Schroeder's testimony and the vents. These actually shields. Now, the testimony was, among all the experts agreed, that you have to ensure, you have to have shields or some mechanism of ensuring that there's space between the cellulose insulation and the venting, the hot venting. And so you have to have something that prevents encroachment. And that was the testimony of all the experts admitted. You have to have something sufficient to prevent encroachment. Now, what Pipestone Plumbing and Heating actually did was they took some tin, they cut some sheets of tin and just kind of stuck them around this vent, and then they put a screw in on one side. And so it was kind of a makeshift attempt to keep separation. At trial, Dr. Schroeder came in and he wanted to show, well, here's what an actual exemplar, this is what an actual attic shield would look like. And Judge Sirska said no. He had the benefit of Kaiser, he had the benefit of Papke, said no, that's not coming in even as an exemplar. And so he excluded it. Now, the pellet issues that they've raised related to the attic shields and related to the type A vents had to do with Mr. Rawls' testimony. So we're talking about an entirely separate, different part of the trial. Now, first they've contended that there was undisclosed testimony for Mr. Rawls to say in cross-ex a comment in response to vigorous cross-examination, a very confrontational cross-examination, saying that although it was technically appropriate to have a Class B vent, the code does not require Class A, but had we had a Class A vent, we probably wouldn't have had a fire. That's the statement they're appealing from. Now, on direct, what Mr. Wallace had said, he talked about Exhibit 26, which went into the record without objection. I mean, Mr. Redmond agreed, it's coming in. This was, we'd been looking for this for a long time and was found prior to trial in Master Blaster's expert, Mr. Cox's, file at his deposition. So finally we have it. And here it says Class A chimneys are required for a minimum of 500,000 BTU chimneys. Now, everyone admitted that this chimney was a 480,000 BTU chimney. So a Class A vent is not required under the manufacturer's standard. And that's what Mr. Wallace testified to on direct. He said it was not required. It was close. It was close. Maybe I would have used one or something like that, but he said, no, it was not required. Now, in cross-examination, in the middle of an exchange, he then made this comment. The code does not require Class A as I read it, but had we had a Class A, we probably wouldn't have had a fire. Now, that offhand statement was not something that we could have disclosed. It was not part of our opinions. It was not something that related to our theory of the case. It was a statement that probably shouldn't have been made. I wish we hadn't made it. But it did not relate to the theory of the case. The theory of the case was that insulation had encroached. It was not about type A or type B vents. And so that statement does not justify a second trial in this case. This is not a case.
Did that just come in without any objection? I guess it was their own question, but was there any attempt to request from the judge to strike that?
No, they made no request whatsoever. The strategy seemed to be to try to use these things as ways to try to impugn the witness's integrity. So, in other words, he would say, oh, you're using, that's undisclosed testimony. It was kind of theatrically cross-examined. The judge was not asked to do anything with these statements. There's nothing to for this court to review regarding that statement. It came out, but it has nothing to do with causation, and it was admitted by our expert that that was not negligence. So it's something, maybe if you'd used a different vent, it would have, we probably wouldn't have had a fire. Is that true? Maybe, maybe not. There's lots of things that might have prevented the fire from happening, but it was not related to the negligence case. So that, you know, sentence from a two-week trial does not warrant a second trial, particularly where the theory of the case was uncontested, essentially, if you look at the expert testimony. There was
any of the objections they have or the appeals on the undisclosed expert testimony, did any of these come in your direct examination?
The only thing that you could argue did is, and with Mr. Wallace, regarding their saying that he never disclosed that you can't let insulation come in over the top. Now, he said that in his direct examination, but that was part of his opinion. And his opinion was you have to have an attic shield that does not allow insulation to encroach. And so that, by necessary implication, means encroach from any direction, from top, bottom, side, left, right, north, south. So all the experts, that was their opinion. And he mentioned in direct, he said, you can't let it come in through the top, and that was about it. That was not objected to. No objection. Then Mr. Redman got up in cross-ex and started to go on the attack about that issue. But again, never with an objection. But it's our position that was completely part of his opinion. It's not undisclosed testimony. And if you look at how they phrase it in their brief, that phrase, attic shield covers, he's suggesting, well, we said they have to have attic shield covers. That phrase was introduced by Mr. Redman in his cross-examination. Mr. Wallace never said you need to have attic shield covers in his direct. He said you have to have something, you can't let it come in from the top. But then in cross-examination, Mr. Redman started talking about attic shield covers. So it's our position that was not undisclosed expert testimony.
What about Mr. Redman's argument today that he got a definitive ruling from the trial court outside the jury on this, and that's why he went into this? Was this something more than a motion in limine, or did he actually get a definitive ruling about this in chambers?
Not about these specific issues. I see no record that he got a definitive ruling on these specific issues. Now, there was certainly a conference about the exemplar vents, and there was also a conference about whether or not the information on this exhibit could go in about type A and type B vents. What Judge Sirska ruled was that information related to the installation of this project, whether Pipestone had met certain code requirements, even though they weren't causally related to the fire, that could come in. He didn't allow the exemplar to come in, but he let us talk about other parts of the code that weren't enforced or that weren't followed by Pipestone, with a limited instruction drafted by Master Blaster, by Mr. Redman, explaining that these did not relate to negligence and they're only being introduced for the limited purpose of showing the overall workmanship on this particular job.
Well, if I heard Mr. Redman right, he was suggesting that your evidence violated some ruling of the trial court that was made in chambers.
I don't think that's true. I have no record. I see no record of that. I was not at trial, but I see no record of that in the transcript, or in the appellate briefs. So what we have here, I think, is it took almost 5 years for these five hog farmers to get their day in court. We had a 2-day or 2-week trial with five experts who testified, but no expert has ever suggested an alternative explanation occurred other than this combustible insulation was improperly allowed to encroach and come into contact with these hot vents. And I think that's because there really is no other, other explanation. So other than this rejected jury instruction that really had no application at all in this case, the defendant's criticisms, they're not frivolous. I understand what they're saying on some of these issues. Trials are not perfect, but the criticisms are minor compared to the evidence that happened in this case. Nothing came in that affected the jury's determination, and nothing was withheld. Nothing was not produced that should have been, and these things that came out on cross-examination were never objected to. So I respectfully ask that this court affirm this jury verdict.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. Mr. Redman, you have 10 minutes, sir.
First of all, the evidence was not without dispute about the wiring in the room. We had direct testimony from an employee who wired the electric heater. And he testified that he stapled it into the wall. And Kern, one of our fire experts, testified that the way that causes a fire is it breaks down the insulation and eventually causes a short. Secondly, we didn't drop Washinger. The problem with Washinger was he didn't even show up until 5 months after the fire. He did no cause and origin investigation. He was shown a bunch of products in storage by Mr. Rollis. And Mr. Rollis led him to believe that the venting, when it was tied together, was not tied together very well. Gases escaped and went and caused this fire, because that's what Rollis believed at the time, 5 months after the fire, when Washinger showed up. Washinger was going to be able to do nothing in this case for us because he had done no cause and origin investigation. And in fact, we didn't want to call Mr. Washinger, and the judge actually allowed plaintiff's counsel to read Washinger's deposition into evidence, where he said that he didn't have any basis to dispute what Rollis said because he hadn't done a cause and origin investigation. And he had also, then we had to come up with a letter from him saying, hey, I have been misled by Mr. Rollis. He told me that the venting was tied together up in the attic and the gases escaped and caused the fire up there. So this wasn't a situation where Washinger was being dropped because he wasn't giving the opinions we wanted. It's because he didn't have anything to add. We didn't have a cause and origin investigator because when we went to the fire, we were immediately told by Mr. Rollis that the washers didn't cause the fire. They were fine. So the only person who had done any type of a cause and origin was Mr. Cox, and he had done that for the power washers. And both Mr. Cox and Mr. Schroeder really didn't need to do much of an investigation because when they showed up, the plaintiff's expert is pointing at the vents. Well, guess what? They didn't have anything to do with the vents. One of the reasons that many of these rulings is so prejudicial to us is because we are in there defending Pipestone. We don't have the cooperation of Pipestone. We weren't able to get their expert down here, even though he'd gone and done an investigation. And we tried to bring them into the lawsuit. Weren't allowed to do so. They were kicked out. So here we are trying to defend this case for an independent contractor who we really don't have any control over. And Mr. Cox was brought in because at least he had been there. And he had gone through the rubble and whatnot. And he said the cause of this fire is undetermined, because none of the factors which could have caused the fire There hadn't been an artifact examination of the L.B. White heater. There hadn't been an artifact examination of the fan, which existed in the wall. The only thing that we had was a statement by an employee who, when he opened the door, it was so smoky, he had to bend down, and he saw some embers falling by the power washers. Well, of course, the attic was on fire. Tammy Lundberg, who had come to work at 5 o'clock, there was no water pressure because a pipe that ran in the hall or in the room had already collapsed and blocked one of the doors, and that was at 5 o'clock. The last thing that I'd like to say, and then I'll sit down, is the fact that Mr. Wallace, and incidentally, Mr. Schroeder, we did have problems with Mr. Schroeder. We filed a Daubert motion because when we took Mr. Schroeder's deposition, he couldn't tell us what the temperature was of the outside vent of the double wall vent up in the attic. He felt that about 300 degrees was what the ignition temperature would be of cellulose, ground up paper, but he had no way of identifying the temperature of the outside vent. He had a suspicion that it was high enough to cause this fire. No testing had been done, no hypothesis, nothing. He actually only had an estimate of the approximate temperature of the gases that were going through the inner pipe. And then you've got the air that separates the inner pipe from the outer pipe, and then you've got the outer pipe itself. He did admit that the temperature is reduced as it goes through the pipe. The other thing that made it problematic here from the standpoint of trying to do something where you're defending Pipestone, an independent contractor, is Mr. Dallas was allowed to testify about an earlier fire that had occurred. And initially, Judge Sirska said, we filed a motion in limine. Judge Sirska said, okay, you're not going to be able to testify about that earlier fire unless you have a report, a written report. I don't want you testifying from memory. Well, he shows up at trial. He doesn't have a written report. He testifies from memory. The only thing we knew is that there had been venting. Didn't look like there was any shields involved in that earlier fire. As best we can estimate, it was a construction project that had occurred in 1995, but we don't know that for sure. It wasn't an All-American power washer unit. We just know it was a power washer unit, and it appeared from the photographs that the vent itself was leaning up against the wood in the attic and ignited the attic. We don't know what kind of vent was used. So here we have the expert, Mr. Rollis, who went to that earlier fire on behalf of Pipestone, testifying in this case against Pipestone. We raised a fuss about that. The judge said, I'm going to permit it. I think it's sufficiently similar. We didn't think it was similar at all. Counsel raises the point about the bill, the fact that there was a bill sent. Mr. Miersma's typical situation with Pipestone is when he's got something that's got to be done, he says, you just call, tell him about what the distance is, what he's putting in, and he gets a ballpark figure. He did that. He got a quote on September 27, 1999. The bill was sent to Supreme Court on October 14th, 99, after the work was done, and he didn't get a bill back from Pipestone until January 11th of 2000. And the bill that was given to Supreme Court was for outside labor chimney work. The whole point of this master-servant analysis is, are you agreeing to be responsible for the work that's going to be done by this independent contractor? I mean, is that in the agreement? Why are you being held responsible for it? Mr. Mersman testified unequivocally.
You're being held responsible because that's what Minnesota law says.
Only if that's the bargain for agreement. It wasn't the bargain for agreement in this case. The mere fact that an independent contractor does work on the project and the bill comes through you because you've made a recommendation does not make you responsible under Minnesota law. Now, if you've agreed to construct the whole house and you sub it out to three or four different subcontractors, you can be held responsible if that was the agreement. That wasn't the agreement in this case. Mr. Mersma testified, I knew nothing about venting. I can tell you, you know, who I've used in the past. It's up to the jury to determine whether or not that is the bargain for agreement. And in this case, we felt that it was error to take that away from the jury.
But that's not the jury instruction you're complaining about.
Pardon?
You're not complaining about a bargain for agreement jury instruction. You were asking for an agency, employee jury instruction.
Frankly, it wouldn't have made any difference what we were asking for. The judge said, right away, I'm going to direct that Pipestone is your agent and you're responsible for it. That's the way the case had to be tried. I mean, we were early on in the case, and he said, I'm going to find that you're responsible for a Pipestone. So that's the way the case went in. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Redden. Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.